Okay, I think we're done. I'm okay. So, this is Maria Carissa Lidou. I'm interviewing David Hammer, and the date is the 19th December 2015. Could you...
I'll turn off the dishwasher.
Okay, no worries. Could you tell me your full name, where you were born, and the year you were born?
David Bradford Hammer is my full name. I was born on 11 September 1963 in Queens, New York.
Okay, great. That... just the typical things we have to do before the interview.
Sounds good.
Can you tell me a little bit about the circumstances under which you decided to come here?
To come here in particular, well, in a word, matrimony.
Okay.
My wife is originally from Enfield.
Okay.
We met abroad when we were both working abroad. In the cruise ship industry. I was a musician, she was a fitness instructor.
Okay.
1992. And we were married in 1993. And then we lived in the U.S., we lived in Seattle, which is where my my family all sort of gravitated to over the years, though we had all, there'd been a lot of, you know, kind of traveling within the family, and as the kids grew up, we sort of got off in different places around the United States. So, yeah, and then we lived there until 1995. We lived for a couple of years in Seattle. And when we decided to start a family, we decided, we thought we would make a fresh start here in certain ways. We thought it was a good idea. My wife is an only child. So, and her child was going to be her mother's and her grandparents' first, you know, great grandchild, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought the support for that would be good. And of course, you know, she's going to have a baby. They want to be nearby and see the baby grow up. So there's a lot of familial sort of pull factor to move here.
So you moved here in 95?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
It's been almost exactly 20 years.
Okay.
20 years this week.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about your home country?
My home country is the USA. Who doesn't know about that?
I mean, in terms of not just the USA, the place where you were born and where you lived.
Well, I was born in New York City in 1963, as I said, and when I was about four in 1967, we moved from New York to Las Vegas, Nevada, which is a huge geographical shift. And within America, it's a kind of a bit of a cultural shift in certain ways, because you're going from this, I'm thinking from my parents' point of view and maybe my older siblings' point of view, that going from New York and then suburban New York, we moved to Stony Point, which is in Rockland County in New York, when I was basically an infant or something. But from there, we moved to Las Vegas in 1967, which is where I grew up, you know, right through school and high school and such. After that, of course, there's five children in the family, of which I'm the fourth. I have one younger brother, one older brother, eldest of the is a boy, and then two elder sisters, who we all grew up in Las Vegas, as I said. And them being older, they, you know, left the family house and starting their own lives. Even as, when I was in high school, for instance, they had moved out. One sister had moved out of state to San Francisco. And so it was just myself and my younger brother still in the family home. And then at that time, after we were both we were both basically finished with high school, and we moved. Now, my dad's lifestyle might explain a little bit in terms of, he's a musician, he's a freelance musician, self-employed musician, and, you know, would be following the work, shall we say, and the opportunities. After Las Vegas, he had an opportunity to do some work in Oklahoma at a resort there in northeast Oklahoma, on a place called the Grand Lake of the Cherokees in Grove, Oklahoma, is where he found this work and where we moved after I was in high school. And then some opportunities became available to me there, namely to get a music scholarship to study at university level to a Bachelor of Music degree, which I ultimately did obtain, through connections, through musicians that I met on that my dad was working with. One of them was the head of the music department at a nearby university and said, I play trombone much more at the time than I do now, but I was playing the trombone, and he heard me and he just said, I can get you a scholarship if that's what you want to do. And so I took that opportunity. In the meantime, about a year or so later, the family moved on again. My dad with my wife and my younger brother, they moved to Los Angeles. So that's kind of where I parted from the family when I was 19 years old. In terms of, you know, that's quite a distance, Oklahoma to Los Angeles. I wasn't going home on weekends to go visit my family. So that's probably, you know, that's an idea of how I lived. I ultimately attained my Bachelor of Music degree, and then I sought work. I would go home in summers and sometimes at Christmas to be with the family. And then when I was finished altogether, I was temporarily, was my idea, going back, and I lived with them in Los Angeles for, it was funny because it was just a matter of weeks before I was able to get a job on a cruise ship, and I started doing that for the next 4 or 5 years. And so that is itinerant as it is, you know, working in the travel industry.
So the working in the cruise ship, which kind of places were you traveling to? All around the world?
Around the continental United States and the Central America. My basic routine was that I would work in the Caribbean for 8 months of the year doing cruises around the Caribbean. You stay down, good boy. And then 4 months of the year we would be doing cruises from Vancouver, British Columbia, up into Alaska. So it was quite wide-ranging. And in between those, to get between those places, to go from your Alaska season to your the Caribbean season for the cruise, it would be by way of the Panama Canal. So if you can just kind of mentally picture a route, you'd be stopping in ports all the way down the western United States and from Vancouver, past Mexico, Central American countries like Costa Rica, through Panama Canal, you'd stop in Colombia, you'd stop in all sorts of places and then make the rounds doing different cruises in the Caribbean.
So that started when you were 19? Or
No, that was after I was in university. I started doing that when I was about 24, 25.
Okay. So your 30s then? Somewhere there?
Well, in my late 20s is when I was doing this. As a matter of fact, like I said, I met my wife. I started doing ships in 1989. I met my wife in 1992. I worked on the ships till about 94. We got married in 93, and then we settled in Seattle during that time. And, you know, I got married 4 days before I turned 30, so it was all serious all of a sudden.
Your mother, was she working, or was she just following the family wherever
My mom brought us up during the time when we were of an age when one would think a mother would be wanting to rear the children. Let's say, you know, I mean, the short answer to that is probably from about 1950. Seven or eight, when my eldest 57, when my eldest brother was born, all the way through the 60s and into the early 70s, she was a stay-at-home mom. So I do remember it being a thing. I was like, oh wow, what are you doing, mom? You're all, she's all dressed up and made up, and she's gone to get work. You know, she's working in, I think she was a cocktail waitress in the casinos or a bar. She would be bar work, cocktail waitress. Sometimes she'd be a cashier. So she was basically doing casino type work jobs that you do in a casino. From the time that I was about probably 10 or 11, maybe, something like that.
Okay.
So she returned to work during that time.
So I know that it's your mother who has a Mohawk
heritage.
Yeah, heritage.
Yeah.
Did she, I mean, while you were growing up, was she involving you in that culture?
Not really. Not involving in the culture, because even she herself was somewhat removed from what many people might think of as the culture and the tribal culture in terms of connections to the larger tribe beyond her family.
Mm-hmm.
So she had a fairly close-knit family herself, and but she was born on reservation land in 1926. She was born, I think, on the Tiendanega Reservation, which is on Lake Ontario in a place called the Bay of Quinte. I'm not sure how they pronounce it, but it's like Quinte. And that's where my tribal registration is with the Mohawks of the Bay of Quinte.
That's in Canada, right?
It is in Canada, that's right. Although Canada is not the Mohawks' ancestral homeland, their ancient homeland is New York, is Upper New York State, the Mohawk Valley. But the history of their nation was such that they were forced to move from there after the American War of Independence, because the Mohawks had sided with the British in that conflict. And when the British finally sued for peace, as it were, they gave up New York in a certain, you know, they had to go be above a certain the border in Canada and around that area. But the Mohawks had been a key crown ally during that war. What was called the Wilderness War, which is not the battles where the British met the Americans, but where the British allied with the Indians were doing sort of tactical guerrilla warfare with settlers and people on the frontier of America. Excuse me. It was pretty nasty. It was a very brutal and nasty war. After a while, the Indians had a concept of warfare that could be, to an outsider, be seen as very brutal and merciless. Anyways, at the conclusion of the war, the Americans were going to have nothing to do with the Mohawk Indians, because there was some very bitter, bitter blood between them. But the English crown awarded them a number of different tracts of land within Canada, within and around the Great Lakes region mostly. And they can still be found today. Those same reservations are dotted around the Great Lakes. One straddles the border between the United States and Canada. It's right on the border. And you know, just getting back to that's the history of the tribe. That's kind of a short history of the tribe. And of course, when my mother was born, she was living in a time, during this time, there was quite a lot of assimilation. The Indians assimilated, you know, Canadian Indians may tell you differently, and Canada may have a look at this history differently, but comparatively to the United States, the Indian people, the Aboriginal people of the Americas, they did, in my opinion, they were the most assimilated into Canadian culture in general, because they had a special relationship with the British Crown, something they called the Silver Covenant, which was it was their original agreement when they said, we're going to fight for the British against the rebels, what were looked at as the rebels. And the British honored that covenant at the end and continue it down to this day, actually, in different sorts of cultural and historic, there have been historical ties going back ever since that time. So you know, the Mohawks and other tribes but particularly the Mohawks, because they're the ones who had to move from the United States after the war. Pretty much they're the main tribe that had to move from the U.S. after the war and into Canada, away from their homelands. And they've always tried to keep the ties with the Crown, saying, we gave up a lot for you. So, you know, we honor you. We need that you to reciprocate that honor, which they did, by and large, quite well. And so things like jobs and things like, you know, career advancement, you know, in some small way were a bit more easier. And, you know, they just maintained that relationship throughout. But once you go hundreds of years forward from that, when people like my grandfather, my mother's father, was one of the people who was working in New York doing the high iron work on the skyscrapers, riveting. He was a riveter, was his specialty, I believe, was. But he was part of a tradition of Mohawks that had been employed. You know, you can still go to New York and see, if you go in the Empire State Building and look at it from the museum, from a museum point of view, because it's part museum, isn't it? And the building of it, part of the, well, there's a mural that shows all of the Mohawks that were involved in building it. And he was one of them. He was one of the people that built all those skyscrapers in the 20s when my mom was born. So when she grew up, she was spending time, especially as she got older, into her 10 and then into her teens and stuff, when she would go with him and he would take the family, because they would, you know, they maintained apartments, etc., for them, and they were able to work back and forth between the U.S. and Canada. That's another thing that does continue to this day. Which is unusual, but it's an old, long-standing tradition and an understanding between the U.S. and Canada and the Indians, that they're experienced iron workers going back for generations, and they continue to do that work. They're working on the New World Trade Center now, and they've been doing that. And maintaining things like communities in Brooklyn and communities back home. She grew up in Hamilton. When she left the reservation, she grew up in Hamilton, which is in Ontario, near Toronto. And that's where her experience and origins come from. But this was a very urbanized and assimilated person.
Right. So what is my understanding is that it was mostly something that was inside of her. She wasn't part of any community in order for you to become a part of that community as well there?
Not necessarily, okay. No. Her interests just simply didn't go in that direction. She referred to them, and she'd tell us occasional stories about growing up when she was very young. And even while she was doing this, as I say, this sort of commute sometimes with her father and her mother. They also had a nice summer home on the reservation that they would go to and spend their time during the summers when the weather was nice, and do all those things, hiking and etc. But it was kind of a weekend thing. And again, he spent his time between New York and Hamilton, both in urban and suburban settings, and was just a person, a normal person, working and earning a living and supporting his family. It doesn't go so far back in terms of maintaining that culture. She really is an example of someone who fully assimilated into. She became American, by way of her first marriage, actually. She married a man that was from New York. It didn't last but a couple of years, I think. There was an issue with his drinking, and she just didn't want to. She got a divorce. But she was a New York girl from her teen years, and in Hamilton, where she grew up. She was really into the popular music of the day. I mean, when she was growing up, actually, she was a dancer. She was a bit of a showgirl from when she was, you know, 15, 16. Still have a few old pictures from back then. They're great to look at. But when she was 18 years old, she was that came to a very sudden and sad end because she contracted tuberculosis. And this was back in the times when tuberculosis, this is early 40s, you know, antibiotics were only barely just beginning. You know, penicillin was sort of being discovered in this time. But they weren't, it wasn't a case of treating it with going through a course of antibiotics. Back in those days, you may be aware that if you had tuberculosis, the world over, you were put in a TB ward. You were put in a place where only all the other people, it's highly contagious via, it's neat, by airborne contagion. It's very, and you basically waited it out. You waited for it to get better. You underwent the treatments that they had, but it was, but it's a, you know, it's a terrible disease that can really waste away the body. The lung, it can be in the lungs, but it also can spread in certain ways to other systems in the body, all of which is, you know, very, you know, bad for the health, and can, they call it consumption, didn't they? The old name for it was consumption, because you, it would consume you. She spent a year and a half in a TB ward when she was 18 years old, you know. For someone who had a life where she was going to be a dancer. And then it finally came down to, they had to perform a pretty radical, what, a last stage radical surgery procedure, which is where they remove an entire lung and part of another one to cut out the disease. And it's a very rapid and radical form of operation where they just turn you over on your stomach. Yeah, they put you under, obviously, an anesthetic, but they turn you over on your stomach, and just as fast as they can, they cut open your rib cage, fold it back, and scoop out the lung. They had to do that to one of entire lung and part of another one. Closed her back up. I'm not sure at what point. I know she spent 18 months in the hospital, so maybe this happened in the midpoint. Long recovery from something like that, but she made it out. She survived it. She was tuberculosis-free, thank God. And but it was the finish of any dancing career she might have had. And I know that affected her emotionally a great deal. But she went on to live and have five children with about three quarters of a lung, suffering occasional bouts of bronchitis and various other lung ailments. And she's going to turn 90 in May.
Wow, amazing. Good for her. Mm. Amazing. Good. Can you tell me a little bit about your life in New York? About, did you have anything to do with the Mohawk culture and their music, customs, and all that?
Culturally, no. Myself, no. You know, I'll tell you, the only real strands of connection we've had with that have been mostly maintained by my youngest brother, Peter. I think he really has kept abreast of tribal matters and indigenous matters on a wider scale in Canada, because that's where our people are from. And as far as contact with them, I only ever went to Canada to meet them once in my life, and it was during the move from when I was 4 years old from New York to Las Vegas. So it was a very transitory thing. And over the years since then, I do know, like my sisters, my two sisters and my younger brother have visited Canada and spent time with our Canadian relations intermittently at various times. My younger brother Pete has he's maintained another thing, which is his other contact though has been throughout his career as a teacher, and part of his career studying was to study education amongst Aboriginal people in general, but also local to where he was living and now lives, which is Washington State, you know, near the Seattle area in the Pacific Northwest of America, where the school he's always worked at Native schools. He's always worked at schools either on the reservation or schools off the reservation that are almost 90% Indian. And that's the way, that he has a special interest in affinity. And that's what he's done for the last 20 years. Except he did live in Florida for a few years, and I don't think his teaching involves specifically within, you know, that community, but most of the time he's been, then they moved back to Seattle and he's been in that area doing that. My contact with my relatives are, I have most contact with my mother's sister and occasional contact with her younger brother, both of whom she's outlived. Her mother died in 1988. Her father died in 1971. It's really a long time ago that a generation kind of passed away, and it really, from her family, she's the only one left. I'm not sure how the family. I'm not even sure how the family extends beyond her. I mean, in terms of what aunts she had and what the family tree, how it extends like that. Something I should look into.
Do you have any connection or any awareness of any Moho community here in the UK or in London?
Not directly. I've heard things I'd like to do, but I've lived here for 20 years and haven't done them. But I know that there are paintings in various museums, and I think in Canada House, I heard there was a statue in Canada House, but I might be wrong, to Joseph Brant, who was the person who was the leader of the Mohawk during that time when they were fighting the French first in the Seven Years' War, and then the American, when they sided. They always sided with the British. That was the other thing. It was two major wars they went with the British, and Joseph Brant was at the center of both of those wars as a leader of the Mohawk. And then he continued to be a leader after they moved to Canada, and he devoted the rest of his life to his people after that move. But in terms of that, so I always try and occasionally look up little connections that there might be. I know there was a lacrosse match here sometime in the last 10 years between the Mohawk Nation, or was it the Iroquois Nation as a whole? I think it might have been the Iroquois as a whole, and versus some university team, it was Cambridge or something like that here. I would have liked to have gone to that, but I only heard about it afterwards. So I think a little bit digging around, I would be able to find out a bit more about the history and the connections that might be here. But no, only really in passing. I think I might have, you know, the Indigenous Voices, the project that you're both involved in. I can't remember if there was a Mohawk involved.
Because you're very well aware of your history, that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, well, that's a problem. Maybe I reached out for that because of this sort of lack of what people might think of as, you know, the cord and the ties that bind. I think my mother just lived her life. She loved what she loved. She couldn't be a dancer, so she started living in New York and going to all the jazz clubs and all of the things that she loved to hear. And she maintained that. She always loved musicians, although her first husband wasn't a musician. But she met my dad, and they fell in love, and they got married, and then had all of those kids.
What kind of musician was your dad?
He was a jazz musician.
Oh, the same as you.
Yeah. He's an amazing musician.
What instruments did he play?
He plays the piano, but he's also known as a a composer and arranger, and has written a lot of recordings for it's famous people like Charles Mingus and Woody Herman, and he's collaborated with them, and he's fairly well recorded, and he's very well respected. Everywhere I've ever moved or lived in the United States, you know, he's not hugely famous, but when you know the real musicians in any area, they know about him, which was always nice.
And when did you become interested in music? I guess your whole life, I guess, since your mother was...
Well, it's funny, yeah. It's funny you should ask that, because I know I had a great interest, a fascination with music well before I actually became practically involved with it. My eldest brother Rob, was keenly interested in music. He was a drummer at first. I never forget when I was that big, Rob getting a drum kit for Christmas, you know, and I was just like, wow. And when he started playing, you know, because he was just a good natural drummer immediately, I was just fascinated by that. And then I always liked listening to music, and I always liked figuring things out, and then if he was out for the day, I'd sneak onto his drum kit and work out some drum beat from something I was listening to, but never really had the opportunity to become involved with it until I went to secondary school, where I don't know how they do it nowadays, but at that time it was they were doing something that I still think is a great thing, which is as soon as you go into secondary school, while much of what you're going to study is prescribed already, you have to, you know, you're always given one elective course, and there was just a range of things that you could choose one subject to be, that's what you want to do. And it was, you know, generally non-academic subject when you first went in. It could be band, you could be in band, you could be in choir, you could be in woodshop, you know, you could take extra art, you know, all sorts of things. And they provide you with the instrument, and it's a class you took every day. You know, it's not something you did after school or at lunchtime. It was something that immediately you go into band, beginning band, and you get a mark for it, you know, for your advancement and all of that sort of thing. And all the teachers are trained to be able to show all the instruments, basically how to play them, and the whole method is... The whole method is, that's what it is. It's a method of getting people who haven't played any, children who haven't played instruments before at all, and take them step by step through the fundamentals of all the instruments as a group. And you're learning from the beginning how to play like an ensemble. You're not sat in some room and, you know, with one teacher learning to toot a few notes. You're all immediately learning, you know, the whole ensemble and the teamwork of it all and everything. And I'll just, you know, for me, when I played that trombone, when I played that first note, and everyone else played once in that first beginning band, it was like a lightning bolt from heaven or something. I couldn't believe what was happening. We all played a note together. One long note. Hi, Sophie. Wow.
I got my hair cut.
You did?
Oh, hello.
Come on in. Come on, y'all. Come and meet, this is Maria. Please come in.
Please come in.
Hello.
Oh, now I need to come into my house.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Hello, Maria. How are you doing?
This is Joanne. Joe.
Hello.
And this is Sophie.
Hi.
And you met Jasper.
Yeah.
Now, why don't you go see them?
First of all.
They've got lots of lovely... There you go. Yeah, so that's how I got involved in music. From there, it was just a case of, for anything that you love, you recognize the people along the way, sometimes afterwards, but sometimes along the way, that are really dedicated to what they do in terms of teaching you. And I was lucky enough to have a teacher at that first point that was very, very important, a very gifted instructor. For emerging musicians. So yeah, that was the beginning of my interest in my training in music, which, you know, like I say, it went through secondary school right through high school. And as I told you, it picked up after that with studying in higher education on the scholarship.
So when you moved to London, what did you do in terms of work?
Well, when I first moved to London, I did what I had done when I had moved to any other new place after the ships, which is you just start making contacts within the, you know, the network of musicians that there are in various ways. So that's what I did in, you know, in 1996 and 97, I began, well, in 1996, I was just starting that and making contacts from various sources. It was a bit lean, but, you know, not a lot of, you know, coming here, it takes a while. Any place where you're doing freelance work, it takes a while to begin to make the contacts, and then you can begin starting possibly establishing yourself, etc. I did one more short 2-week contract, I think it was, on a ship, just something fell in my lap. But then we decided that I should probably get some sort of teaching qualification as something, you know. We had one by this time. We moved here 6 weeks after Sophie was born, so she was an infant. And then when she was getting close to a year old, and that's when I started training. I got a PGCE in music education, and that allowed me to basically have a, you know, the opportunity to be working. And I picked up a job at my second school that I'd been placed at for training during the certificate course, you know, and worked. So I just started teaching, basically. At the same time, I did start getting more work as a trombonist, and that sort of carried on. But with the arrival of more children and all of that, I kind of found that my ability to really stay current as a trombonist and keep my edge as a musician was difficult, very difficult to do when you're working full time. In other words, you got to practice, you got to try and play every day. And I also wasn't able to make things like rehearsals during weekdays. If you have a gig, they might want a rehearsal before it. So I was sort of had to step back from doing it to take care of business, you know, having a home, having a roof over the head, food on the table. But then I transitioned into playing another instrument, which is the vibraphone. I changed over to playing, you know, the tuned percussion, because during my undergraduate degree, when I was getting my bachelor's, my primary instrument was trombone. My secondary instrument was percussion. So I just transitioned and focused on that more, because there's a different way you're able to maintain that sort of playing.
What is the second instrument? I don't know what that is.
Well, secondary instrument.
Okay.
You know what I mean? You have a primary instrument, one that's your first study. As a music undergraduate, you have if you want to get a music undergraduate degree, you generally, in most courses, you have to have a primary instrument, called your major. Your major instrument, we call it in America. Your major instrument, your minor instrument, and everyone has to have a certain degree of piano proficiency. So it's an all, you know, because it's a practical degree. I wasn't getting a bachelor's in music education. It was a bachelor of music degree. So you have to do what has traditionally been considered that, including taking, you know, foreign language. You have to take either Italian or German or French. Actually, it was only Italian or German because of the fact that I don't know if you have any formal experience in music, but music terminology, when you're reading a piece of music, it also can be surrounded by other little notes about how to play the passage, and they will often be in Italian or in German, because traditionally those are the cultures that really kind of invented music, the literary side of music, writing it, you know, the mezzo piano to play something medium soft, mezzo forte, medium loud, German terms for how to sing a certain passage, or you know, those. So that's what you have to do. It's a very well-rounded, for me, it was a degree that fit me very well. I started out as a music education degree, but ironically enough, about a couple of years into it, I was like, I'm not ever going to teach. I'm going to switch over to music.
But you teach.
I do. That's the ironic part of it. 15, 20 years later, life changes, doesn't it?
So things. Now you teach, but you also play?
I also play still, yeah. I also still run anything from a trio to a big band. You know, I do all sorts of different ensembles that I am generally the leader on. I'm the side man sometimes, and I still occasionally play trombone on the occasional gig.
Do you like teaching?
It's all right, but mostly, you know, I'd rather be playing music. Mm-hmm. Much more, I'd rather be involved in creating or working on a project or whatever else, you know. I struggle to get motivated within the system the way music is taught here, to be perfectly honest, because it's quite different than it is done in America. When I went on this course for the PGCE in music education, I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. I didn't know how radically different it would be. I didn't know how much I had to learn about the way the subject is taught here and the way children are just educated in general here. You know, there's a lot of things that I don't support, don't get. I understand why they are here, and I would hardly even think that they could be reformed to what I would think would be in many ways, more beneficial system. But it's, if you're gonna, you know, you don't have to take music in America. When you're here, you have to take music along with other of the arts. You have to, okay? In America, you don't have to. It's elective. For me, that makes it much better. It makes it hugely better. It means you haven't got all these people who hate music. And that's the thing. Most kids, most teenagers love music. It's a huge part of their identity. But you then are pigeonholing it into something that they have to work at and either be good at. And a lot of them are just turned off to that. I want to listen to music. I want to enjoy music. I want to learn how to play it badly. You know, it's something that, for me, I can run ensembles. I can train ensembles. When we're doing the extracurricular here after school and I'm conducting a orchestra or running a small band or something, that's why I'm in my element then, because I can do it till, you know, I can get results. I can take any kids at whatever musical level they're at, and I'll get results. I don't care. But when it comes to being in the classroom where most of them, you know, are just going to be defiant or not into it, and you have to teach them the creative side of music, you know, that's, you know, for me, it's about coaching them to interpret the music. That's what it is to me. That's what music is to me. That's how I learned the best. That's how so many of the musicians I know learned the best, and they're fantastic musicians. You know, they're the best musicians in the world, the Americans.
Aren't there schools here that are specifically music schools, so that there are children who are interested?
Yeah, that's great if you got money, and that's another thing. You know, if you want to hear my political opinion on it, you know, I would not hold back at all. You know, if you want to make music your life's path, then you better have someone with money in the bank that's going to put you through it. Simple as that. And you have to pass all these silly exams, and those exams cost money, and all the tutoring you get costs money, a lot. So what you end up having is only a certain sector of society makes up your professional ensembles and your professional freelance musicians. They all kind of come from a fairly homogenous middle class area. And that lack of opportunity, I think, is extremely unfair for everyone concerned. I think it's unfair for the parents. I think it's unfair on the students, that on the people. Music knows no class. Music, artistic ability, is a gift from the Creator, you know. It's not because your family can afford it. I think that is a terrible thing, because I think it's an opportunity denied, an ability that is denied and almost suppressed, not given the opportunity. You know, if it's not there for you, it's not right. It's not right at all. So, you know, those sorts of feelings, when I think about my skill set and what I could bring, there's not a lot of points to actually get into a system that could use my abilities to the best that they could be used. So, I do it with the pros, I do it with professional musicians, and don't get professional rates most of the time.
So, I understand that in your family as well, you go on with the culture and with everything that has to do with the UK customs and the culture and everything. Do you try to pass on to your kids any Mohawk heritage?
Only from a historical perspective. That's usually what, and the family fact, perhaps, you know, with varying degrees of interests on their part. I think my middle girl, Sabrina, is probably the one who was kind of sought out the most interest in it. I would like to reconnect with it, without a doubt. And I know I will someday, because I could. You know, if I move back to there where I am registered as a tribal member, which I can, because my mother is a Mohawk, and that's where they draw the line. You know, if you're half Mohawk, if you're half Indigenous, you are, or more than you register, which brings in certain factors of your relationship with officialdom in Canada. You know, but if I move back there, you know, there would be housing. I would have a house. I would have a place to stay. That sort of a thing. But way beyond that, I mean, that's just kind of an example of what is a, you know, kind of something I'd be interested in going back and doing sometime. Probably during the summer when it's nice and warm. Because Canada just becomes one blanket of snow in the winter time. So they're aware of it. I think they find it unique. But they're London kids. They're growing up in London.
How many kids do you have?
Three.
Okay. So
I've got a 20-year-old daughter you just met.
Okay.
Sabrina is 17. And my son Ethan, who's also home upstairs, he's 13. He's 13. Gonna be 14 in less than a month. In about 2 weeks.
Are they following your steps in any artistic way or something?
I suppose in a broad artistic way, both of them you could say are. Sophie is now at acting school, and Sabrina is doing a diploma in music course, a level 2 diploma, according to the BTEC syllabus, in college. She takes singing lessons and guitar lessons, sometimes guitar/drum lessons, depending on her mood, because she goes to the same teacher as my son, who's a drummer. Ethan plays the drums, and Sabrina, and they at the same teacher. Sometimes she'll take a big guitar, sometimes she'll learn drums.
Oh, that's amazing. So they're all following your step.
Well, they have an interest, so you know, that's all I can ask, and all, you know, that's all any of us can ask is if they want to do that, then you know, we'll see. I think Sophie has sights on professional. I wouldn't say Sabrina necessarily thinks she'll go to the route of professional performance, but I think that she'll learn things on the course she's doing that may take her in directions that are associated with the industry.
Um,
Did you find any challenges when you came here in terms of culture, in terms of work ethics or... Yeah.
None that I have, you know, I wouldn't say culture and work ethics. I think, again, you come to a place that's you know, you do realize that, because I do, you know, I think of myself as an American. I think the Americans and the British are two sides of the same coin. I think they have so much in common with them, but sometimes they're joined at the back and they're looking off in different directions. And that is like, you know, that's sharing the language, but having a worldview culturally that is quite different from, that can be radically different from each other, but you can also see very strong roots, very strong compatibility between, ultimately between their visions, you know, but culturally, I think you look at it, Americans place a lot more importance on self-reliance, on independent judgment, as a person, as an individual, and as in terms of the family as well. It's quite different here. It's liberal Europe, the politically that trickles down into what the culture is, and the political is a result of the culture. I'm sure the same thing is in France. France shares a lot of American values, quite a lot, in spite of what people may think, and certain aspects of what they see are very important too. I think they're a little more balanced than America is in certain viewpoints. America does think a lot about a person's individuality and their own personal code and personal morality. French does, you know, broadly speaking, if I could say, I think they have a greater idea of the culture and the state as a whole, and the importance of maintaining their Frenchness. That's very, very, very important, I know. But it's headed in a different direction than America has taken those same ideas. It's obviously more, it is more socialist, it is more to the left in terms of government. Let me set the target. But coming here, I wouldn't say I'd struggle to fit in, not at all. You know, I'm sort of personal, kind of personable guy that I think can communicate well with people, if maybe more directly than the British like. I think if that kind of answers what you were getting at.
Yeah, sure. I did some research on the Mohawk heritage, and I saw that their religions has something to do with animist, believing that there's a difference between that there is good and evil, and these things like... you know, have a way with each other. What is your religion? Did your mother have anything to do with that?
Neither of my parents had any religion. We didn't practice any religion whatsoever. I know my dad went to church when he was a boy, but that was just something that you would do if you were growing up in America in the 30s and 40s. But I don't think, he was never religious. And my family wasn't particularly religious. I mean, his family wasn't particularly religious. He was from Michigan, the upper Midwest. So that's a little unusual for that time. I do actually share a certain degree of animist views. They you know, in terms of good and evil, they I'm not sure how much that actually, it is a bit more of like the spirit of everything. It's about everything having a spirit, you know. Aww. Sort of like the Buddhists, you know, in a way. That everything that is living or even inanimate or not living, you know, not, you know what I mean? Like, even rocks, everything has, is part of a kind of a spirit. It has its own. All, not only Mohawks, but all, nearly all Native American, and I'm talking about more North America than, say, Central America and all those cultures from South America, but the great, you know, the United States and the Canada, that part of the North American Indians, they all, it was animist, you know, almost across the scale with everyone, which they did believe that there was evil in the spirit world, that there were tricksters, that there were people who were just mischievous, or spirits that were mischievous. But, you know, I don't look at it like that, and I don't, I'm not, I have my own sense of spirituality, but I don't explore it to any real great degree. I guess I have my own kind of morality that I try and stick to, and I leave it at that. I try to be an honest person. I try to be the kind of person that I would like to be, that there is, I'd like there to be, that people would treat each other in a certain way. We're all human, though. We all get mad. We all have flaws. We all have a mouth that said, that runs away with us, that we know we shouldn't have said something. But I like to think that underneath it all, I maintain my own rationale and my own morality and my own reason, that I like to set an example. You know, if not for society, at least for my family.
Okay. Do you think, do you miss home? Do you ever think of going back with your family there?
Yes, I definitely do. I've felt it much stronger of late. It's always, I'm very close to my dad. My mom is suffering, and has for the last few years with a number of health ailments. And it's come pretty close. So even over the last 20 years, it's come close in terms of her health. If her, you know, if she gets bronchitis particularly bad, her lungs can just go into seizure, and it just, you know, we got to get her to the hospital like that. She has to have oxygen at home. She has to have, I think, therapy on a fairly regular basis at the doctor's. She is suffering from dementia, and it's progressive, as the nature of that disease is. She lost the sight in her in one eye a few years ago, unfortunately, through something that, had it been spotted early enough, it wouldn't have happened, but then became irreversible. It would have been very easy to deal with. She's got very poor vision in the other eye, and she's profoundly deaf. Not entirely, but it's a combination of things that are becoming, you know, a bit of a strain on my father. And but luckily, he's got the support of the family, which all lives nearby. But ever since my sister's visited a couple of months back, and one of them let it be known that if you want to come and stay, you can just stay with me. Don't worry about it. And if you want to spend time with mom, and I think I'm going to probably be taking her up on that early in the coming year. So yes, I miss my family. All of us are close. We're an unusual family in everyone's ability to accept everyone else. And no matter, you know, where we've all been flung all over the place. I live in London. You know, at one point I was in London. My sister was, actually not quite. She did end up moving to Seattle sooner than that. But at one point, yeah, we were quite spread out. Oklahoma, Las Vegas, Seattle, Los Angeles, and just all over the place. But we've always maintained contact. We've always gotten together on the holidays. And I've got lots of nieces and nephews as well. So there's a large family back there. So, you know, who wouldn't miss that?
Did you ever think of going back home and living there?
I have thought about it. And it could happen. But it's not going to happen anytime really soon. I think it may. It would be a retirement option, is what I'm thinking.
Yes, I understand. Because, you know, your kids are growing up here.
They're growing up here. Their lives are here.
Yeah,
I respect that. I don't have any real opportunity there. I suppose if an opportunity came along, that would take some serious thought, because it would have to be a ridiculously lucrative one. And, you know, the way my life has gone, I'm not expecting any ridiculously lucrative opportunities anytime soon. I've been struggling with a cold. I'm so sorry.
Oh, that must be an issue. Oh, you have a cold.
I say struggling. No, I've just been annoyed by a nagging cough for the last week and a half. I had the cold itself for about 2 or 3 days, when it was like nose was running and I was coughing constantly and all that. And then that went away, but then I just kind of got this dry throat when I talk at length. And the cough comes in occasionally.
And you talk a lot in your work as
yes,
well.
Yes,
so.
That's right.
And you have
Would you
a
like
really,
some water?
No, I'm fine. And you have a really strong voice. You know, it doesn't be heard, so, yeah. So you're working at schools, right?
Yes. I work for an agency, a teaching supply agency, you know, when teachers at schools are ill or for whatever reasons not able to teach in the lesson because they're on a school trip or getting ready for a concert or whatever it might be, you know, they need people to take that place. So I generally teach general cover, you know, as long as I get the cover work, I can teach anyone anything at a high school, at a secondary school level. Or occasionally, like today, and over the last couple of weeks at this school, they've needed a music teacher there. So it's been nice to work in my specialism. And besides that, I'm a freelance musician.
So where do you play?
I play, well, I've got a big kind of a 10-piece jazz band that I do that plays once a month regularly down in South London. And then I just pick up a few other things besides that. The type of places I play are generally pubs and jazz bars or jazz clubs, with occasional special projects. Besides that, things where you might play as part of a church concert series or, you know, wherever people want to hear some music, some jazz music.
Okay. Do you see yourself as an indigenous artist?
No, I would say no. I don't see myself my personal creative or expression or musical expression is very much within the tradition of American jazz music. Although not necessarily a narrow band within that. I'm familiar and. Because of my dad and because of just growing up with it, with all styles of jazz, from early to completely free jazz to all, you know, jazz rock, all the different parts of the genre. But as far as, I'm sorry, can you repeat the question again?
If you see yourself as an indigenous musician,
oh, right,
artist.
Yeah. Mm. No, the things that I do are generally interpretative. I don't do a lot of personal creative music other than the fact that jazz is highly improvisational. So you know, when I'm playing the music, it's in that moment. So, and it's again within this genre. I have thought about trying to find some connection with that, and it could happen. I could definitely see it because I've been sort of intrigued by it since Michael has got me involved with this, for instance. But he, a year ago when they were getting ready for Last Summers, he mentioned if I wanted to get involved with it. And I was intrigued, but I didn't think it was the right time. But I'm keeping it in the back of my mind to see how I could do a project that could work. It's the nature of music within Aboriginal culture is something I would have to really stop, and I'd have to set aside my own preconcepts of music and throw myself into what is here, and do I want to just go with a pure version of that, or do I want to blend it with my own experience, which I'm sure would be much more successful, or at least I could make more progress in that immediately. So I'd like to see how it could be integrated into what I do as a musician.
Okay.
But as of yet, that's not happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't think I have any more questions. Is there something you would like to add? Or an experience or anything?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I know that you probably... There's every chance that other interviews that you've done like this have been from... Every interview is going to be unique. Everyone's a person. So that means every interview you do is an experience of a person's life. So there will be people, I think, that are probably closer. Obviously, there's going to be people who are closer maybe to the traditions of their people than I, for example, am. But I am fascinated by the historical I'm a person who's fascinated in general by books in history. I can't get enough of it. You know, I do. I like to see what outcomes of previous things that are like the world now or previous... You know, where you see something that's happened in history and you see it now happening again in our world, and it's like people aren't recognizing it for what it is, kind of a thing. And and any Indian issue, any Aboriginal issue in general, you know, I am firmly a staunch supporter of their own issues, you know, and the things that they face when authority tries to interfere or they have grievances. I can entirely understand it because I do know, and I'm well aware of not just the general long and quite sad history of the end of that entire population in that part of the world. That's an easy reason not to believe in God for me. No problem at all. Because, you know, you can't tell me Jesus died so that all the people... So that the religion that came out of his teachings could then get someone like Columbus to go over and first try to make slaves out of the Indians. And the Indians were the worst slaves ever. You know, they were like, you know, you could just beat the crap out of them. They're like, what are you doing? What are you doing? I'm not going to work. What are you talking about? You know, they were not slaves. They were not good slave fodder. Because they either died of the disease, they died from the whippings, or they just didn't do the work very well, so they'd get beat to death. And eventually, they just decided, let's just kill all these people and bring slaves in from Africa. You know, you can't tell me that you can't tell me there's some creator out there who's like sitting by watching this happening and saying, you're right, but you're wrong. All the rest of you guys are wrong. You're right. You know, no. Not, you know, so that's my view on that. And there's loads of details about, you know, a lot of people just don't really know. They have a general idea that about how the suffering is gone, but there were so many more people in America, you know, when it was first discovered. And long before they even discovered that they got to the white man, all the white man's diseases went out and killed so many villages. They would precede white exploration by hundreds of miles, thousands of miles, because the Indians would go from one village to another and be spread. They had no immunity whatsoever. And it's a long and very sad tale. But I do understand that I would like to get involved in the living culture that remains. That is something I am determined to try and come in personal contact with. But again, retirement options.
Yeah, and I think now you're mentioning all that. I mean, in terms of media and publicity on this issue, there's not much coverage. I mean, these days, I mean, you don't hear.
The only coverage, no. But what is news coverage? News is just like, this is news, you know. They come and buy it, and then they consume it, and they eat it. And then it's gone, and then we just want another one. And if this one tastes as good as this one, then that's what I'll keep getting. That's my news. And all of these lovely little chocolates are my news, right? And the people who are deciding, because decisions are made about what's important about news, aren't they? That's what an editor does. He decides what is important, and news is entertainment. Long ago there used to be a line between news, entertainment. Now it's all entertainment is news, and news is entertainment. And the most entertaining thing is the thing that gets people to stop and stare, and that is mostly conflict. You know, you don't hear about, oh, the world was beautiful yesterday. Wasn't that a lovely sunrise? You hear, these people killed these people, and you need to hate these people because they hate you, or they hate these other people, or they're coming to get you. And that's news. Indigenous Americans long ago became no news, nothing to do with news. They're not a threat to us anymore. There's not even hardly any of them left. So they'll never make the news again. The only time they ever make the news, when do they make the news? It's when they get pissed off and run a blockade on the reservation, say, you can't come here anymore, which is what they did. There was some serious stuff happened on that reservation that was between New York and Canada. It's happened a couple of times because it's a bit of a gray area. It's like part Canada, part U.S., but all U.S., it's all reservation. And the only time you ever hear about them is when they have a grievance, you know, and in some ways that's good. But mostly that's when their entertainment value increases for the people like Rupert Murdoch and Ted Turner and all the other media people who sell everything, who are just making the, you know. So, you know, you can turn on Strictly Come Dancing, or you can turn on the news, and they're both precisely the same thing. Money. They're just money spinning. They're just something that people will buy something for some reason. Which is all very sad, isn't it, Jasper?
Okay, I think we're done.
Oh, good. No, I'm just getting started. No, let's keep rolling.
I don't know, but you don't see many Indian characters in films as well. I mean, I saw Fargo, this season.
You like Fargo?
Yeah.
Good.
There was an Indian character.
Yeah.
Who was the bad guy, but he was a very interesting character.
Yeah.
Because, did you see it?
Yeah. I've watched both series.
Yeah.
I've watched both series.
Yeah, Fargo's really amazing.
I'm glad you like it, because the thing is, if people got into the original film, did you ever see the film? You must have.
Yeah,
that even had a little Indian character in it, didn't it? And they try and work that stuff in, and they do it in a way, and it's good that they present him as an interesting character, regardless of his background, has nothing to do with your interest in him as a character. And that's a great way to present him. You see other media portrayals. They've fallen all over themselves to try and improve the perspective that they're presented from and how what they bring to the film and what their character brings to the story being told is not, you know, it's not this one or two-dimensional thing. It's becoming more three-dimensional, more like this is a human being. This is a bit of his background. We can tell what his background is, but we're not going to make him do things that sort of perpetuate any stereotypes necessarily. And that's what you have to watch out for, you know. I don't tell everyone. People are often surprised to find out I'm Native American. Others aren't. I do supply work all the time. And almost about every third school I go to, if I get to talking to the students, they'll always ask me. They obviously know I'm American, and they say, "But what are you from? Where's it? Was you know?" And they want to know because they can tell, you know, that basically my eyes is what gives me away. And but they can't figure out, you know, what it is. They always ask me if I'm Chinese, and I'm serious. That's not just like them being. I've had Filipinos and Japanese ask me if I'm Chinese. All the, you know, when I was working on the ships. So I guess I look more Chinese even to Asians. you can find them. I would highly recommend a film by Bruce Beresford, a Canadian film called Black Robe.
Black Robe.
Yeah, Black Robe. You as a person from France might find it especially interesting. Because it came out about the same time as Dances with Wolves, which I was never that. It's an okay movie, but it's a little. I don't know. It's okay. Black Robe though was the movie.
Black Robe.
It's called Black Robe, and what it is about the Black Robes and their first. They were amongst the first to go out amongst the Native Americans, the Jesuit priests, the missionaries. They were the first French people to go out, the ones to try and run missions into the villages. This is going back to the late 1500s, early 1600s, long time ago. And it's just a really beautiful film about the clash of cultures. The Dances with Wolf kind of makes it go, it makes it too stark and in your face, and it just descends into kind of white guilt. And but Black Robe takes the spirituality of a Jesuit priest and puts it face to face with the seeming brutality of Native American existence. But then, and the dialogue and the way they speak to each other, the things that are found out, and the characters presented, you know, it's like they're shown as maybe being brutal in some respects. But one of the main characters in it, in the film, is this dwarf Native American who spends the whole time being carried around on the back of another full size Native American character, and he's the one who has most of the dialogues actually with this Jesuit priest, and it's brutal at times, but it's a real it's really gets you thinking about the real clash of cultures that happened back then, because he just goes out there and spends and lives with them for years, and they think he can cure them, you know, with all of his zim-zali-bim stuff when they get diseases, but he watches whole villages just die and all of it happening, and it's even done from the point where he doesn't quite understand that it's probably germs that he's brought or his related people have brought that have killed all of these. And that's not, you know, because they wouldn't know that, would they? They didn't hardly know that, you know, that that's what was happening. So, see it if you can.
Yeah, we'll try to find it. Okay. I don't know if you have something else to say. I think I'm done.
No, I'm good.
I think I have all the information I would like to have from you.
Okay.
So, yeah,
all right.
I'm quite content.
Well, it's my pleasure. If you, I have a few pictures I could send to you.
That'd be great.
I have your email address. And again, if we just maintain, this is an ongoing project, obviously. So just keep this on file.
Yes,
and when I go back, especially, I could show you pictures more to hand of my mom's family.
Oh, that'd be great.
And
if you have any pictures here, you could send me for now, because I don't know when they will be, because they will use some part of the information from the interviews into a documentary that they're doing.
Right.
And I don't know when the documentary will be.
Right, yep.
So if you have anything that you think is
okay,
you would like to share with us,
you
can send
it. Absolutely. No, I'm happy to maintain it. You know.
Okay.
It's very nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Dan and Zendaya.
Yeah.
You could